Hi, I'm Amanda, one of the hosts of The Suburban Women Problem. For the next few weeks, we're sharing season two of our limited series, The Cost of Extremism. Extremists across the country are attacking our freedoms, and kids and families are paying the price. This five-episode series will take a deep dive into crisis pregnancy centers, book bans, the crunchy mom to alt-right pipeline, and more. Jasmine, Rachel, and I will be back after our spring break. But in the meantime, we hope you enjoy this investigation into the true cost of extremism.
Extremists across the country are attacking our freedoms, and kids and families are paying the price.
There are some really fascinating, little known, but very important contributions that women were making to the rise of white supremacy and white nationalism as we know it today.
A lot of the work that we have done, whether or not we were pushing for comprehensive reproductive and sexual health education, we have done that in partnership with local churches across Christian denominations.
The people who are willing to ban books don't actually value reading.
This is The Cost of Extremism. As season two of The Cost of Extremism draws to a close, we're excited to bring you a final bonus episode. Throughout the 18 interviews featured in these last five episodes, I've been inspired by these remarkable women and their efforts to advocate for their communities. While we couldn't include every story, they all deserve to be heard. Today, we're joined by Jo, who you may know as JoJo from JERS, for an in-depth conversation about three stories that are particularly relevant today. First, we have author Sayward Darby from Episode 5, The Crunchy Mom to Alt-Right Pipeline. During our interview about white women's role in the alt-right supremacy movement, Sayward discussed the historical portrayal of white women as martyrs. From literature to popular media, the image of the sacrificial white woman has been perpetuated through countless depictions, all in an attempt to recruit more followers into their white supremacy organizations.
There are some really fascinating, little known, but very important contributions that women were making to the rise of white supremacy and white nationalism as we know it today. So, I mean, certainly in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, you had white women in the South, especially, who were, first of all, very comfortable being held up as symbols, right? These figures, feminine, maternal, who were in some way physically threatened by the releasing of slaves, by the complete shift in what our country looked like, who was free, who was not. So, I mean, you look at the first blockbuster film, Birth of a Nation, and what is the plot in that movie? It is about a white woman under threat and the need, the sense of duty to protect her from these hordes of black people. It's just, I mean, it is, on the one hand, like a tale as old as time, because obviously, like that, I think that paradigm of a white woman under threat from a person who is not white is an old, old, old trope. But again, it became this galvanizing thing in this period in which people who especially did not agree with the way the country was going were trying to find symbols, were trying to find ways to justify the kind of violence that they thought was necessary to restore things to the way they had been before. All of the women I focused on in my book came to this of their, maybe with a guy, like somebody that they happened to be with, but not because of a man, and certainly not under duress. So, but I say this just because I don't want to suggest that the far right is some like happy space for racist women, because it is incredibly misogynistic. But in terms of how men think and talk about women in the space, there's an absolute contradiction, because on the one hand, the smartest amongst them know how important women are. You cannot have a social movement with men alone. Like, it's just not going to work. And so women are absolutely necessary. In terms of the actual goals of the movement, celebrating motherhood and the idea of having children, having a lot of children, that is all very, very important. And so men are quick to hold up motherhood as this incredibly important act and choice. They are also very good at putting women on pedestals, and similar to what I was talking about with Birth of a Nation, saying, this is what we're fighting for. Like, look at this beautiful woman, maybe clutching a child to her breast. Like, this is what we are fighting for. And she deserves our protection. And so there's this, which is, of course, its own sexist idea that women are always in need of protection. But I think it resonates with a lot of people.
Lots and lots of thoughts about that one. I just want to start with, it's so relevant to this time period, because we've just seen Katie Britt's State of the Union Republican response, which is dripping with this narrative, right? Like layer upon layer of this narrative, where she not only like does the other people or the brown people are coming to sex traffic you thing, but like she talks in the fundy baby voice, and there's all of this exploitive behavior and language, exploitive of women, but exploiting this whole fear-mongering thing about those people that are coming for these women, right?
That's what I thought of. The first thing is the rhetoric on immigration and the way that the fear-mongering and the positioning of it, especially, like, it's just ramping up so much lately in this election season, of the bad people are coming across the border. So we need to keep them from coming to, you know, protect our women. They're rapists, they're gangsters, they're drug peddlers, they're sex traffickers. And then you see those politicians who go to the border, like with their guns and like trying to look all macho, like, don't worry, we're going to protect you. We're here. We're not going to let these people cross the border and get to you. That's just kind of what it makes me think of.
Yeah, 100%. Like, okay, first of all, if anybody's going to be protecting me, it's not going to be Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham. Let's just put that out there right now, okay? Like, I think they would probably be like, can you help me? Can you? And I'd be like, all right, hold on. I got to take off my heels first. But yeah, it's true. And it's part of the reason that they're doing this, and it's actually having some success, quite a lot of success, is because they don't have anything to run on that they've done that is an accomplishment. But fear is always effective, especially mm-hmm. when you keep driving it. And they're really consistent with this messaging. It's been carried through for generations, right? But like, they're really ramping it up now because they need people to be irrationally afraid of something that they may not see directly in their lives, but it's out there. And they're doing it with Lake and Riley too. It's two prongs of the same fear fork, right? So like Lake and Riley, it's the suspect in her murder is an undocumented individual. And what the right has done with that is the same thing that what, you know, she was talking about in your interview, is like, it's this threat that we need to protect women from, because this illegal, as they say, came here to do bad things, which is largely not true, because statistically speaking, they're incarcerated less by 60% than citizens. But the fear is the point. The need us to be afraid of those people, of they, them, those people, others.
Yeah, and the fear is the point, because it's like, if we put the fear in people and then we prop ourselves up as the rescuers, like, okay, you're scared, but don't worry. We're here. We're here to protect you. And then that's what Sayward was really like going at with, like, white supremacy, like how men in the movement attract the women. They're like, you need to be scared, but you come join us and we can protect you. And so I think we need to be aware of that. And the other thing that made me think of this, you know, as a white woman, I'm like, we have to recognize our privilege and not get too comfortable in our privilege. We have to always learn, and we don't know when it's going to come out. We want to say that it's not going to come out, but it might come out. And it makes me think of the bird watcher in Central Park a few years ago, the black man who was just bird watching. And there was a white woman who identified as a liberal white woman who had her dog off leash. And he said, excuse me, you're supposed to have your dog on a leash. Can you put your dog on the leash? And something came in her, and she felt so threatened and actually called the police on him, knowing deep down that if she called them as a white woman and said, I'm feeling threatened by a black man in a park, that they were going to come to, you know, quote, her rescue. So that's something else that makes me think of it. Like, it's ingrained. And I think we just have to recognize that privilege and, you know, push back against it.
Yeah, and that's hard to do, right? So to acknowledge your own biases, like that is really difficult. A lot of people can't get there. That's why a lot of people sort of repress things and to the point where they have resentments that sort of spill over into other things like that, right? Because it's the privilege that we embody, but we don't realize because it's like gravity most of the time because we've just had it our whole lives. But it's also that messaging that's ingrained in us, like you said, that we don't even realize is has been pumped in our faces, pushed in our faces our entire existences. And as moms, that's something that we have to be cognizant of, you know, with our own kids. And I think just having a conversation about being cognizant of something like white privilege, like that's two white ladies talking about, like, I did not know the privilege that I was walking through this world with, which is a hard thing to admit too, because then other people are like, that really literally is privilege. But it's like, I can acknowledge it and I want to do better to make sure that I understand where things are coming from so that I can stop doing them and stop perpetuating them without even realizing it.
Yeah. And one way we do this, you know, is through learning and talking to people and, you know, things like DEI training, things like social emotional learning. All these things that, you know, the right extremists are trying to take out of our schools. These things are trying to, you know, be part of the curriculum in our schools and like our kids, like learning these things and unlearning things to be better people and better citizens. But then it's like, no, if we have like a community full of empathetic, compassionate, understanding people, then where does our power go? That's where I think it comes from, right?
Bingo. And that really ties to the book bans episode too, because it's this, you know, idea of not exposing people to, you know, other realities or making sure that we keep those other existences in the shadows. And it's all this, it's part and parcel of the same idea, you know, and it's, unfortunately, that's how you perpetuate these systems, systemic differences where our society is skewed so that all the power is up here instead of spread across, you know, every community. And that's because that's by design, because they don't want to yield that. They don't want to give that up. They really feel like they have a birthright to it.
Yeah. Keep us afraid of the other. So then the people in power can still hold on to that, like, I'll protect you kind of thing.
Yeah. And the fact that women are such seemingly eager foot soldiers in this, like, you know, misogynistic, racist, Christian fundamentalist ideology, and that they're undermining their own existences to prop up men who really just want to use them as birthing vessels and, you know, objects of pleasure, et cetera. You know, that's really sad to me. Again, that's what we saw with Katie Britt. You know, this is someone who was coached to changing her whole demeanor. Her speech was changed to sound more submissive. It's not how she talks. And by the way, can we just talk about the fact that they put her in her kitchen and that she was okay with that? Like, this is a U.S. senator. I don't have to like her. I can acknowledge that that's a massive accomplishment. The youngest Republican female ever as a senator. And they put her in her kitchen and had her talk in such a way that was so undermining and demeaning. And all of that is, again, this sort of willingness to be a foot soldier to benefit men, white men.
And I think one reason why we don't have these conversations, because we're so afraid of saying the wrong thing, and we have to get over that fear. And so I think when you speak up, and I'll be honest, it's something that's hard for me and I'm trying to get better at as I'm getting, you know, older, more mature, wiser, I hope, is that, okay, I'm going to say something. And if someone, you know, calls me out or has some, you know, critique of it and questions it, then I'm going to take that feedback and listen to it. I think that's the other thing. I'm trying my best. I'm not going to get it right, but I'm here to learn and get the conversation going.
For our next bonus clip, we have Cherise Scott, the founder and CEO of Sister Reach, a nonprofit that supports the reproductive autonomy of their community through the framework of reproductive justice. In episode 1, Crisis Pregnancy Centers, an anti-abortion healthcare crisis, Cherise highlighted the different ways Sister Reach has worked to meet people where they are in their advocacy work.
I am an artist before I was ever an advocate. So merging arts and culture to be able to make the work that we talk about, whether it's abortion or LGBT rights or harm reduction or whatever it is that we're focusing on, mental health or substance use disorder, to try to make it palatable for people, whether we're using theater or spoken word or some type of music or singing, some type of performance to make that a bit more palatable. But our culture change work also looks like our faith-based organizing and working across these interfaith spaces. When I started Sister Reach and I moved down here, back down here to Memphis, I knew that we were not going to be able to do our work well without working intentionally with most definitely the Black Christian church, especially since Memphis is predominantly Black and predominantly Christian. And so that being said, a lot of the work that we have done, whether or not we were pushing for comprehensive reproductive and sexual health education, we have done that in partnership with local churches across Christian denominations. Us partnering with our churches has been one of the greatest organizing tools that we have had here at Sister Reach. It has allowed us to reach people in mass where now we're not even allowed in the schools, because if you ever advocated for abortion or if you currently advocate for abortion, you are not allowed in the school system. And so that for us has been our pivot, right? And our way of working with our community and really making the connections that these are the same people that we're talking about. We're still serving. Majority of the people who come through our doors identify as people of faith, and they need abortion care, and they need emergency contraception, and they need an HIV test, and they need a harm reduction kit, and they need condoms, right? And they need resources, they need housing, right? So there are all of these things that these are not different people because they go to church, right? These are just an extension of their lives, and we're just meeting them at that particular intersection.
Charisse was incredible. And I'll be honest, like, I've interviewed a lot of people in this job, and she was one that's going to sit with me forever. Because one thing, and she said it at the very end, meeting people where they are. And I feel like that's kind of the opposite of what crisis pregnancy centers are doing. So a crisis pregnancy center, someone goes into it looking for help, and then they want to project their own agenda on that person. Mm-hmm. They want to convince them to keep the pregnancy. Like, that is their goal. Like, they're like, we have an agenda, you come to us, and we're going to project like what we want you to do. What Charisse mm-hmm. is talking about is meeting people where they are. Like, okay, where are you? Like, where are you in your life? What do you need? All right, let's see how we can help you and get you to where you want to be. And so that's what just like really struck me. And then I love that she works with the faith communities, because, you know, there are quite a number of faith communities that promote that purity culture, but it's just not realistic. And it's just almost like a fantasy, that purity culture. Like, we're not understanding bodies and sex education and like all the things that people need, where Charisse and Sister Reach, they're like, okay, what do you need? We have the information, we can educate you and support you. So I really loved learning from her.
Yeah. And it's fascinating in that episode, because personally, I did not know really anything about pregnancy crisis centers. I'd never really even heard the term until I joined Red, Wine, and Blue. I was like, I didn't know what that was, or anti-abortion centers, as I now learned they should probably be called. But when I hear her talk, and it's all about uplifting and providing choices and options and empowerment, it is literally the polar opposite of what these centers are designed to do. They're designed to remove your choices, suppress your power, oppress you. They're making the decisions for you, and they're making them for you by lying to you and scaring you. And so, like, it couldn't be a starker contrast. And so it's, what are we saying to society that we want women to understand about themselves? That they have no autonomy, or that they not only have autonomy, but they can be a million trillion things all at once. They can be, you know, a practicing Presbyterian or Catholic or whatever it is. And they can still acknowledge that they need to make choices in their lives as far as, you know, their desire or no desire to have a family, or if they need, like she was talking about, all the different kits and medical care, and even as much as a condom, that they have the power, the autonomy to make those decisions for themselves. And I think this is another really fascinating conversation because no one else is having it. And when I heard the numbers about some of the things that the budget that they spend on like Google ads and Google searches and stuff, $10 million. You don't realize how pervasive this is if it's not part of your reality, but it's massive.
Yeah. And they're so deceptive too. The other interview we did with Malia, like she told her story of going to one of these centers. And Charisse has her own story too from years ago, which she didn't go into detail, but she went into more detail of the work that she's doing now. But she talks about what really changed the trajectory of her life is when she finally learned about her body. And that's the thing. Like I have a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old. So, you know, their bodies are starting to change. They roll their eyes and get really annoyed if I try to have a conversation with them. But I want them to understand that it's normal. There's like these changes that are happening. This is your body being your body. It's not anything to be scared of. It's not something to be ashamed of. And I think a lot of times, specifically women, like there's just so much shame with like the things happening in our bodies to the point where we don't fully understand them. And Charisse talks about that, like that education, like you have to understand your body. We're talking about preventative care here too. Like that's what she does, you know, a lot of her work and understanding how bodies work and how to prevent things from happening that you don't want to happen.
I totally agree with you about the idea of shame, so much so that we've created a culture where women weren't even talking to each other about miscarriage. One in four pregnancies, I believe, ends in a miscarriage. And when I had my first, I didn't know there was a sea of people in my life that I had one too, because no, we never talked about it. And when I said it, all I got was, me too, me too, me too. And I was like, what? Why don't you talk about it? Because of the shame, right? But you know, something else that is a huge component of this is that these marginalized, communities and these underserved communities and people of color are already in crisis because they're not getting the services that they need for health care, right? And going back to this being systemic, but I love this because what she's doing is she's the opposite of that. You know what I mean? Being proactive about that. And again, it's another conversation that's not happening on as broad a scale as it should. But I think that this episode in particular really highlights that, because I think a lot of white people don't realize the disparities that exist in this country.
Finally, we have Nick Stone from episode 2, The Growing Movement to Ban Books. As the New York Times bestselling author of Dear Martin and other young adult books, Nick theorizes that the push to limit access to specific books originates from a fundamental lack of appreciation for reading among those advocating for bans.
I tell people all the time, sometimes it's just about finding the right book. But the truth of the matter is, the people who are willing to ban books, the people who want to keep, quote unquote, certain books out of the hands of children, don't actually value reading. So it's a battle that we kind of have to be very strategic about fighting, because you can't get somebody to care about something that they don't see as valuable in the first place. To me, it's telling when the books I read in high school were the same books my mother read in high school, and that kids now are still reading the same books, right? So when you have these books that are looked at as these are the books you read in high school, after a while, like, most people aren't actually reading them, right? I think that because there's a certain sector of society typically, and these are people who typically wind up with a lot of political power for some reason. These are people who didn't value what they read when they were younger. And I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that they couldn't connect with it, right? Like it wasn't actually interesting to them. How much of the disdain for reading comes from the fact that we tell kids they have to read things that they are completely unable to connect to? I don't know a single high schooler who was able to connect with The Great Gatsby. I don't know a single high schooler who was able to truly connect with The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, right? Even books like To Kill a Mockingbird, I remember a few years ago when it was voted the Great American Read. It's like America's favorite book. However, it's a book about racism that published in 1960, right? So the way people read that book, it doesn't connect them to life now. And I wonder how much relevance has to do with why reading isn't as valued.
When Nick started talking about this, I kind of felt like it was a light bulb moment for me, because very common talking point kind of from the right side of things is I have heard people say, oh, but the reading scores in schools are so low. We can't be talking about DEI. We can't be talking about social emotional learning. We got to focus on the basics like math and reading. So when Nick's talking about this, do you know what gets kids to read? It's reading books they're actually interested in. It's reading books they can connect to. So, you know, if you're really concerned about reading scores and kids not like learning how to read, then you're like taking away books that they actually want to read. And Nick, you know, tells the story like in the episode about, you know, her book, Dear Martin, which I did read and it was incredible, how a boy reached out to her and said, this is the first book I've ever finished because it was interesting and I could relate to it. And that just like really stood out to me. And I know that is, you know, with my own kids, especially when they started learning to read, one thing that my daughter really loved was graphic novels. And I had, you know, parent friends like, oh, my kid only reads graphic novels. I'm like, well, they're reading, right? And so like my son wasn't really into books. And then I ended up getting him this Newsweek magazine and he would read that cover to cover. So it's like, if you're really concerned about kids reading, make sure that they have access to things that they're actually interested in. So that really struck me when Nick was talking.
I'd never considered the fact that part of the problem is that these people who are crusading against books with specific content, and you talk at length about the types of content we don't have to guess at, right, that they're going after, but it's where other people feel seen in the books that they're reading, and then they're naturally inclined to be interested in those books because they see themselves in those books and in those stories and then part of society, and it's really perfect for engagement in that way. But the idea that maybe these people who are on this crusade didn't have those kinds of books to engage with. They didn't see themselves. Nothing resonated or clicked with them in that way. They obviously didn't grow up with a mindset to care as much about protecting them or encouraging those stories. In fact, it's possible that the opposite happened, right? So that they became resentful.
I don't understand that mentality of, I didn't have that, so I don't want you to have that. What a sad way to live your life. You know, like they say, I've heard it before, like you parent your kids the way you had wanted to be parented. And, you know, I catch myself doing that and I know I'm not doing it all perfectly. And there's, you know, I'm trying my best, but that's the thing. Like maybe I didn't have access to these things as a kid, but now I want my kids to have access to that. And I can see in real time what connecting over books can do. Like it has brought my two children together. They love the Percy Jackson series. They talk about it all the time, the Greek mythology, all of that. It's something that they find interesting and then they can connect with each other. And that's what storytelling is. It's connecting. It's getting excited about something. You might see yourself in a story, or you might learn about somebody else in a story, you know, that you don't see in real life or don't experience in real life. And it's just like opening a world of compassion and empathy and curiosity, all these things I think you and I want for our kids. And it just makes me really sad that there's our parents who are like trying to stop kids from having that.
Yeah, I mean, that empathy component is massive because as we know, every day navigating life at the moment is difficult for us and for parents, for everybody, for kids, because there's so much division. It's everything feels like it's kind of like being compressed and all of our differences are being highlighted and then used against each other. And part of the way that that's happening, or part of the reason that that's happening, is because there's a degradation of this idea of empathy and humanity. Because once we start to think we're just different, that there's nothing that's alike about us, it's really easy to other those people. And they're not like us. I can't connect to that person. I don't see anything about that person that makes any sense to me. We're just different. We just clash. And that's what is the byproduct, the natural byproduct of keeping people apart and removing realities from society. But if we can instead go back to integrating that better, right? So many of those stark divisions between us, when we start to see, oh my gosh, wait, hold on. You like, you know, Spider-Man? I like Spider-Man. Like it's, you know what I mean? Oh, you like to cook? I like to cook. Oh, you know, you have these same thoughts and concerns and worries and you don't look anything like me. We don't have anything in common. Like, oh, I had no idea. And then once you get there, right, then it's a lot easier for people to connect with each other. And then by virtue of that fact, there's less stark division and more societal unity. And then you want to help other people. The whole thing is like a just big ball of happiness and joy. Well, not perfect, but still it's, and that's what we want for our kids, because we want to leave this world a better place than we found it. And we want them to do the same. And if they're always looking at people like, I don't understand you, I don't want to know anything about you, versus I want to know all about you and I want you to know all about me. I think we will leave this world a better place if we can get, you know, stop this sort of attack on people's existences again. Because it's leading down very dark paths.
Yeah. And I feel like this is like bringing it full circle from the start of our conversation, is that fear. We've got to get rid of that fear. If we like build up that fear of the other, then it's just so divisive. And, you know, reading a book is such an, about like somebody else's experience or seeing your own experience, is just an easy way to get through that and just to build that. So I think that's why some feel very threatened by it. And I think we're just going to keep saying, no, we're not cool with this. We're not going to let this happen.
That's all we have for season 2 of The Cost of Extremism. But don't forget to subscribe and follow Red, Wine, and Blue to learn more about how we can change the world together, one suburb at a time. The Cost of Extremism is hosted and narrated by Jill Jonasson, produced by Abigail Martin and Ashley Hufford, and written and edited by Abigail Martin.